Okay, so this question has risen before. I think I already answered it earlier today. That the ego can grab onto the numeric scale and think, well, I'm 480 and they're 460, so I'm better. But, you know, the ego can do that with anything. And it does do that with everything all the time. That's the quality of the ego, which you then project onto everything. And, of course, we can do it on a scale of consciousness, but we can do it on anything else. So that's just a propensity of the ego. And one of the things we have to relinquish is the desire to be better than others, because there is no such thing. And better in what meaning of the word better, etc. Okay. Are there spiritual differences between men and women? Oh my, this is a damn... Leave this one right there. Oh, here was a springer, honey. Did you know this was in here? Well, I'm allowed to ask this question. There are spiritual differences between men and women. He says, no. No differences. Not, yeah, you know, the essential reality obviously would have to be the same. However, the way they manifest tends to be perhaps different because it reflects cultural influences. It is permissible in our culture for women to be intuitive, to call upon the nonlinear side of their awareness. It is not so okay for men to do that. It is not so okay. And a man has to be somewhat more evolved to give himself permission to call upon his intuitive side. You know, so in our culture, the woman is more free to be intuitive, and therefore she perfects that side. I think she perfects that side. As a psychiatrist, I'm speaking now. She perfects that side before the man does. That's a fact. Yeah. The man who's mature and not challenged by the feminine begins to then look at her as a teacher of the intuitive side of life, just as she looks to him to the doingness side of success in the world and all. So she learns traits that were once considered masculine, and he learns traits that were once considered feminine. The secure adult, the secure male, acknowledges that quality, in fact calls upon it, and admires it. He says, wow, that must be terrific to just know something out of the blue like that. How do you know that? She says, I don't know, I just know it. He says, wow, that's pretty cool, you know? And he begins to see that it's perhaps a valuable tool, especially when she's been right 6 or 8 times and he's lost on every single stock he bought. And honey, I don't think that company's gonna hold up. But his reason tells him it will. She says, I don't know, I just get a funny feeling that it's not gonna work out. So he begins to see that she has some kind of a other avenue of knowingness and knowledge, and he begins to admire that and say, how do you get to be that way? And so he begins to listen to her, and she teaches him then how that happens, and he begins to respect it and develop that in his own self. And so you have the amalgamation then of the feminine and the masculine on the psychological level within the mature individual of either sex. Each side begins to admire the other and say, wow, I see the advantage of that. Teach me how that works. So in the end, the man and the woman admire and support each other. As I say, I think their qualities spring forth depending on the particular culture. They don't calibrate differently. They are the same. And you can take You can view things differently than I do. Everyone has a right to be wrong. Yeah, the question is the woman's intuition sometimes wrong? Well, sure, we all get hunches that turn out to be incorrect, you know. Anyway, that is, I think, a quality that we learn in spiritual work, you know, a sensitivity to an inner knowingness. And that, again, is a skill, I think a skill, which is learned from experience. Some of these questions we've answered many times before. If you read the book, these will answer themselves. Isn't the calibrated level of consciousness due to the belief system of the person involved? And actually, the answer is no. And we've demonstrated this many times because you don't have to express what it is. You can hold it silently, and you'll see I often do it with her. I'll say, what I'm holding in mind is a fact. She doesn't know what I'm holding in mind, so obviously her belief system can have nothing to do with the answer. We're talking about Kundalini energy, the spiritual energy as it begins to flow up as you get into the 500s. You feel this energy running up your spine, and it's exquisite. It flows up, well, in this case, it flew up, it flowed up the whole back, although in the spiritual esoteric literature, it's described as running up a special channel, the Sushumi or some fancy name. Anyway, the energy is exquisite. And in that's usually the high 500s. And this aura of love is very powerful. It also is capable of paranormal phenomena, what the world calls paranormal, and that may last for some years. In this case, it lasted, I don't know, maybe 5 years or something, in which one is clairvoyant, clairaudient. You have whatever is that called, where you touch this, you know exactly who it is and why they put it there, and you know the name of the person, and you see them. What is that called? Something like that. But those various things come and go, and they're surprising at first. You can fix electrical equipment, picture it as being fixed, it fixes, turn strobe lights on and off, all kinds of fancy tricks with it. But those come and go. Those are phenomena of the field. Also, the miraculous is commonplace. The miraculous is continuous almost. What you hold in mind manifests, and healings take place, all kinds of miraculous phenomena. And it lasted 5 or 6 years. It was continuous and quite strong. And that was the same time this energy was flowing up, flowing into the brain, and exquisite, pleasurable sensation in the body and in the brain. And it would just flow down, and then, as I've described elsewhere, for some unknown reason, it would flow out, usually to some disaster in the area. And this, like the healing energy, would flow into the disaster, and the car's wheels would still be turning. And this energy would flow into it and have profound effects. The miraculous was the consequence of that field. It has nothing to do with me or anybody else or you. Somebody says, so-and-so performs miracles, so-and-so doesn't perform miracles. The field does it. The field doesn't consult you at all. It just does what it does without asking. the roses would suddenly turn red and you just witness it. You know, you don't see it. You don't think, oh, gee, I wish those roses could turn red and they make it happen. No, it's no such thing. It all happens of its own. Those are the so-called classic cities, spelled S-I-D-D-H-I-S. Of which one is best, I forgot to forewarn people about that. Also, not to become enamored of that, not to think it's you. When it's real, you realize it. I mean, it's very apparent it's not you. It's the field. And the field is not the personal self. There's no volition volition at all. One doesn't decide, gee, I think I'll help this poor old crippled lady get healed and walk up and walk away. It doesn't happen that way. You're sitting there looking at the clock. The old lady sits down. She's all crippled up, can barely walk. This energy just does what it does. She gets up smiling and walks away fine. Nobody asked you at all. You were not consulted. So those are the cities, but they can be pursued for their own glamour, for their own. If the ego, I don't see how that would happen, because they don't really happen until your ego is pretty much gone. But I guess in some, the residual ego grabs onto this and begins to try to own it and become a professional at the thing. Anyway, so those things come and go, and they're not to be, they're just to be witnessed. And if you're curious about it, you can ask somebody who's been through it, and they'll just tell you, it comes and goes. It's very entertaining while it happens. I mean, it's really entertaining. You can drive into a big parking lot and know exactly where the one space is. Right? You can park in front of Lincoln Center and find the one only parking space on the street, right in front of Lincoln Center. Number one, right next to Lincoln Center. Probably the only parking space within a square mile of New York City. And you just go and park right there. It's like nothing. You knew it all along. Course in Miracles tends to lead you into that state, by the way. Okay. Are there any other courses similar to the Course in Miracles? The only reason I mention that is because I'm familiar with the Course and familiar with, of course, many other ways. All the spiritual pathways take you through, you know, the legitimate ones take you through the same thing, whether it's unity or science of mind, or they're all dealing in basic spiritual realities. Now, the thing about a spiritual reality is not so much what the statement of the reality is, but the practice of doing it. So that brings us to the next most important thing. Radical devotional non-duality. Gee, that's impressive, isn't it? Radical devotional non-duality. Oh, boy. Oh, yeah. What is really implied is that the commitment reaches such an intensity that it's nonstop. People say, how do you really reach a very advanced state of consciousness? The desire, the commitment seems to increase in intensity. And then there's a point where you realize that you are going to sacrifice anything that is required and you're going to make a run for it. All obstacles are put aside. This is when the family is certain you've gone crazy. You leave everything. And now the spiritual work is continuous, nonstop. There's a fixity of focus. People say, I've tried this method, that method. No, they didn't try it. They dabbled at it. Because if you do it continuously with an absoluteness, a ferocity, then you'll transcend whatever level that is that you were at when you started that. If you absolutely and totally surrender every thought, feeling, attitude, positionality as it arises, you see it arising out of nothingness, you see it cresting as a thought, idea, feeling, and the willingness to surrender that to God as it arises. First, the wave comes up and it completes the whole story. Poor old Bonzo, how you got run over by the car, tears come to your eyes as you remember. You got this whole sad story here. The willingness to let go all that sentimentality, all that mucking around in the past, the willingness to let it go. So the story shortens. You start to think of poor old Ricky getting hit by the car, and then you start to think of poor old Ricky. Then when you get more to the present, before it's Ricky the good old golden retriever, it's just dogness starts coming up. And then before it's even dog, You can feel it's an energy potential coming out of a source of thinkingness itself. Out of the void, out of the nothingness, out of the blankness, out of the silence, arises this like fountain of thinkingness which gradually takes its form as a thought, then an image, good old dog, good old rover, and then the whole sad story evolves out of it. When you ride the crest of the wave, it's pretty much like surfing. You stay on the crest of the wave. If you get behind the crest of the wave, you get drowned in the past. If you get ahead of the wave, you get hit from the butt. So you're going to ride the crest of the wave. There's nothing like keeping you on the west crest of the wave than being on the crest of the wave, especially if there's severe consequences, like an electric shock if you get off the crest of the wave. So we could train spiritual people with this technique, and if they get off it, okay. Instantly, you catch his mind trying to anticipate the next shock. I got him already. I know what his mind's doing. He's trying to anticipate the next shock. So he's trying to get ahead of the wave so I won't hit the button. But I'm going to hit the button because he's trying to get ahead of the wave. So it's a self-motivated technique. When it's done intensely, it can be a form of meditation in which one perfects this technique. With the perfecting of the technique, then, without disturbing the satori, in the world, the Buddhists call it satori, without disturbing the state, one can then get up and walk around and maintain the state. In the beginning, if you open your eyes, the state disappears. Satori disappears in the beginning. It's only possible when your eyes are shut, form of meditation. As you perfect this letting go-ness, then the state maintains even though you open your eyes. There's an inner silence in which one is above the crest of the wave, and it maintains even though one opens one's eyes. As it becomes more established, one can get up, uncross one's legs, open one's eyes, and walk about the room, and the state continues. All these have different names in Sanskrit. Anybody here born in Sanskrit? Nobody. So we won't speak Sanskritese because there's nobody here from Sanskrit. But they all have great names, classical names in Sanskrit. The condition becomes established then as a permanent way of being with the energy of life, and eventually becomes independent of any effort whatsoever. That's the value of the contemplative way of focusing on context. So as you walk around the world, there's a letting go of the content. So what we're talking about is disappearing content. We're talking about the disappearing of content, and the content is the product of the ego. And as that is surrendered, one becomes the context and realizes one always was the context. Okay, so either in a meditative state, in the contemplative state, one does the same thing. One lets go wanting to change things as they arise, wanting to edit them, wanting to take a position about them, wanting to devise an opinion about them, wanting to have a feeling about it. Finally, all things are surrendered as they arise. And you walk about like you do in the woods. Mostly in the woods, you're not going from one little, well, yeah, people do. They do that, don't they? They go from one little object to another. Oh, God. Look at this acorn. Look at this squirrel. I guess they just stay fixed right here in the center and go from content to content. Generally, a more meditative person gets the space, the infinite peace and space of nature. And that's why many people prefer to meditate in nature, because it's easier to focus on context. There's no television going, there's no conversation, there's no other people, there's no traffic, there's no distractions to pull you back into the linear domain. So to transcend then, one's identification with the ego, we let go of this form, and then what happens is the power of the context transforms. The more we let go of the content, the greater is the effect of the context. It's the power of context, then, that is responsible for our existence. The ego would have you believe that it is the source of your continued existence, but it's not. We exist in spite of the ego, not because of it. What keeps you afloat is your buoyancy, and the buoyancy is your relative energy as compared to the field. The field is so powerful, like a giant force of gravity, that it sustains you. And you think, well, it's my flailing in the water. That's what's keeping me afloat. What's keeping you afloat is the specific gravity of salt water. Not your flailing around in the water, understand? So it is safe to let it go. It is safe to let it go. And this letting go-ness of the belief systems of the ego are always accompanied by fear. That if I let this go, then the fear comes up. That's why you hang on to it. So by the time you get to the final doorway, you will have had a lot of experience in facing fear, surrendering that fear, facing fear, surrendering that fear. Each level of consciousness then, as you enter it, is marvelous and wonderful. And then at the other end, you see it's capped by fear. You see that fear is now becomes the block. So again, you walk through the next fear. So anybody who's done any very intensive meditation is aware of that. The sense of self reaches a certain point and suddenly fear arises and one feels like pulling back to the previous identification of who you are. The feeling if you let go at this point, you're going to become not me. You're going to lose yourself, lose your sense of self. So that sense of losing who I am, my identity, my sense of self, arises over and over at each level. Each one of these levels is capped by, if I let that go, I won't be me. Therefore, the role of faith in spiritual work. There's blind faith, and then there's more advanced faith. There's the faith of naivete, which leads many down the road to destruction. This faith is the dark side's greatest weapon. Every great killer of humans, to have faith in that which is in error is deadly. So faith in and of itself is not a virtue. It's a stupidity unless you know what it is you have faith in. If you calibrated Milosevic, if you calibrated Hitler, if you calibrated Stalin, if you calibrated Bin Laden, I would not advise having faith in them. And yet many do, isn't that correct? Whole nations put faith in the megalomaniac over and over and over again. In one lifetime, I don't remember how many put their, whole nations put their faith in a megalomaniac who sees to it that his entire nation is destroyed out of his megalomania, and he will say they deserve it. They deserve it because they lost the war. All Germans deserve to die. Hitler wanted to burn down all of Germany, didn't he? They don't deserve to live because they lost the war. No, faith is scary. You have to know what you're having faith in. So you can only trust those who have gone before, who verified that the ice is okay to walk on there. I wouldn't put faith in thin ice, so a lot of people do, and that's why not too many people reach the ultimate goal. One has to qualify what that is that you're putting faith in. Faith, however, has a different meaning. It means faith, and it really means conviction. All right, faith in the form of conviction, the absolute certainty that one
is following that which is absolutely the truth. That's a different kind of faith. Faith in the proven. Oh, that's different. Faith in the proven, but I would not put faith in that which is unproven. Faith in the proven. How is surrendering everything to God different from passivity? Oh, that's a clever question. It's a psychological question, actually. Surrendering, what is one surrendering? That's a good question. One is surrendering willfulness. One is surrendering one's will. Passivity is down here. This is passivity, the failure to take action where action is called for, apathetic. And there are some spiritual techniques that lead people into apathy. They think they're detached. They're not detached. They're apathetic. There's a group in Sedona. They walk into a restaurant, and waitresses all go, oh. They never leave a tip for the waitress. They think that's wanting people's approval, you know. Instead of seeing it as gratitude and love and acknowledgement, you see? So it's a miscalculation of what it's about. All right, so, it would seem like passivity, but it seems like passivity only to ego. You see, what is surrendered is the willfulness, the spiritual will. And so all spiritual work is really surrendering one's will to God, one's will to God. I want this side to win, I want that side to win, you know? So there's a willfulness. So what one is surrendering is one's willfulness. That the world should be different than it is. There is absolutely no reason at all that the world should be different than it is. There's not one single reason this world should or needs to be different than it is. Should it be different than you perceive it? Well, that's different. So the best thing to do is not change the world, but change how you perceive it. Think all the work you save yourself. If this is the great school, why do you want to take it down? We just have to build another school anywhere. God evolves along with human consciousness. Isn't he lucky? Happily, his good luck is that I think what the person means is our comprehension, our understanding, our awareness of the reality of God. Yes, it very definitely evolves with human consciousness, as we see over on the left-hand side here. Yeah, God does improve. His God's going to throw you in hell. He hates you because you're a sinner. He condemns you to eternal damnation. You're so distasteful, he doesn't want anything to do with you. Here he's just punitive. He's only interested in punishing people. And here he denies himself to you. You call out for him, oh God, help me. Because you're just a worm. So here he gets even with you for screwing up. Here he couldn't care less. This is the God of indifference. Sort of the Sartre. Sort of Sartre. Sartre calibrates about 220 or something. Anyway, he couldn't care less. God is an indifferent. God is like space. If you're there, that's fine. If you're not there, it's fine. Space couldn't care less. Here we start getting into freedom, courage, the courage of choice. In other words, here we see opportunity, support, inspiration, absolutely merciful. For God not to be merciful, he would have to be judgmental. To be judgmental, he would have to suffer from dualistic perceptual distortions. If he suffered from dualistic perceptual distortions, he couldn't be God. And if he isn't God, you don't have to be afraid of him. So anything that's anything that is judgmental you can forget about, because he's as bad as you are. In fact, you're probably higher than he is. So these horrible gods that wait for you, coming out of ancient scriptures, are, you know, from the unconscious anthropomorphic projections. At least, God is inspirational and hopeful. Yeah? And because you're at least merciful to that which lives, you can presume God is at least as high and evolved as you are. Anybody can forgive your mother-in-law or his ex-wife or whatever. All right. And as you do this, you finally come into wisdom. The difficulty with, which we see in politics mainly, is in its impact on life, is that it's correct as far as content go, but it what negates it is the context. You know, everybody's out with a parade about their freedoms. I'm a taxpayer. I'm free to picnic in the woods. That's my right. They're entitled. They all have rights. My right to picnic in the woods. Except when there's a drought. No, you're not allowed to picnic in the woods during a drought. When there's extreme fire danger and millions of acres are already burning and houses are burning, no. So, all such things then are subject to content. It's only so under certain conditions. That's sort of the basis of situational ethics. A thing is ethical or unethical under what conditions? That which is pedestrian ethics then fails to reach the point of wisdom, because the point of wisdom, what's the difference between the intelligent and wisdom? Well, wisdom, where is wisdom? Wisdom, I don't know where he went. Wisdom is up here, okay. All right, wisdom then takes into account context. The foolishness of the youth who did it, or the culture in which he comes, you know, totally changes the meaning and significance of that thing. For this person to do it, it would be heinous. For this person to do it, it's probably, it's just stupidity. So we constantly modify it, and to pretend that that is not so is the pitfall of certain political positions, which don't see that in times of war, things are different than in times of peace, in times of drought. Your right as a picnicker is different, you know? If nonlinear dynamics is a product of the 400s, it isn't. So that answers that question. The intellectual construction in describing it, yes, is in languaging. However, the nonlinear dynamics is a whole field itself. Spirituality, you understand, is the subjective world in which we live. We talk objectively about things out there in precise language and all, but we don't live there. Where we live is in the instant-to-instant contact with our own subjectivity. Life is experienced on the subjective level of consciousness itself and nowhere else. Why? Because you cannot experience it elsewhere. The only instrument available to you to experience your own existence is consciousness itself. Were it not for consciousness, there would be nothing to know science and make any declaration about it, because there would be nothing that registers its existence and believes in it. So, therefore, all absolute reality is subjective only. That which is considered objective is a positionality. It's a perceptual definition. All that the ego perceives is really a tautology. It is what it is because you say it is what it is. It's like we all commonly vote that it means that, but tomorrow we could change the vote, now it doesn't mean that anymore, because it has no independent reality. That which is real, you cannot change its degree of reality by voting on it, you see? By common agreement, we say this means that, and this is valuable now. Then a decade later, we say that's not valuable now, and this is illegal now. What is the white brotherhood? I'm not a an expert on such things. Other people are. I'm mainly familiar with only one volume, and that is the volume on glamour. It's, I think, from the higher celestial realms. They are evolved teachers. They calibrate quite high. And then again, there's a downside to it, where there's a lot of ooh and ah about it all and all that, you know. The truths that are transmitted should stand on their own. Stand on their own. I was telling you this morning about the seduction of the fallacious teachers, spiritual teachers, is a glamour. The same as Hollywood, the same as all the hype, you know, all the glitter and shit, is glamour. The White Brotherhood did a book on glamour. It was channeled by Alice Bailey. The book on glamour is excellent. It is useful. It is, it describes glamour as an energy, an energy that we project, okay. All right, it describes glamour as the attraction, the energy of attraction of certain things. So it's useful, and all these teachings are useful within their own context. All of them are useful. That the attraction of certain things is almost like an energy that gets, it's almost like a glue that gets stuck on them, or a scintillation that gets shined upon them. And they're not intrinsic to what the scintillating light illuminates. That which is glamorized by dramatization is not the same as what you think it is. It's an exaggeration. So the value of that is that we exaggerate certain things because they become overvalued. There's other questions here I can't answer because I'm not an expert on the esoteric. It's not necessary to become an expert in the esoteric to become very spiritually advanced. It can be, you know, an entrancement of its own right. There's endless books, there's endless channelings, there's endless treatises. And what one gets into is other domains. The energy fields of the inner planes and all. All of them are quite interesting. And if you find somebody that studied them for 20 years and become enlightened, then I'd pay attention to them. I never have. It's not really the pathway to enlightenment. I'm not saying it's not so, but it's a distraction. Many things are not so, and are distractions and dead ends in and of themselves. One then sounds erudite. You can use many fancy terms and all kinds of Sanskrit and elegant languaging for the field of energies only. Is that necessary to know? No. Not necessary to know. Did the Buddha teach about it? No. Did Christ teach about it? No. Did Krishna teach about it? No. Well, if the great avatars of history, the greatest teachers ever lived, have not taken the time and the energy to explain this to us, then it's probably not too necessary to know it, is all I can figure. Yeah? Krishna said, listen, you better learn all this crap or you're never going to get up here. By God, we'd all pour over it, wouldn't we? But I don't know. He didn't say anything about etheric bodies or energy fields or any of that stuff. he had a heck of a time. Jesus had a heck of a time. Don't kid yourself. They had a hell of a time. Once you get over 700, start to be very difficult. And we've alluded to that. The aches and the pains as you're attacked by the demons and those that hate God and don't want to see human power dominated by spiritual truth and rather keep control of you and take a dislike to you. It's very handy. The Buddha would have done better if he'd known kinesiology. I told him that. Why don't you learn kinesiology before you get on there? Jeez. He said, no, it can be done without kinesiology. I said, be my guest, all right.
Now, we only need to know what's necessary to know, and it's not that it's harmful to know these other things, but to be aware that they're distractions. They're distractions. Don't forget, most of them are perceptions. You're back into the level of form. Even though you're talking about energy fields, which are non-physical, form also prevails in the non-physical. So, form can take a physicality, but it can also be a non-physicality, such as a concept or, you know, various astral realms and all. How is it determined which individuals gravitate to which levels of consciousness? Is this material? You know, we explained that in an earlier lecture. It's more like gravity. You see, the spiritual will, which is the focus of one's karma, all one's spiritual decisions then are encapsulated, you might say, imprinted in the transistor. What do they call it in computer work, you know, that registers everything? Whatever it is. Every decision then. You see, we live in a purgatorial realm of an infinite number of instant-to-instant choices and decisions. Each one of these influences the power of our energy field, the etheric, the higher spiritual bodies, instantly reflect every choice. This determines where our position is in the overall, you might call it, gravitational field of consciousness. So it's like consciousness is an infinite gravitational field of infinite power. And one of the staggering things you see when you go through the final doorway, not only the exquisite beauty, the incredible peace, but the infinite power. If one could intuit the amount of power it takes to keep every molecule and every atom together in the entire universe, the power is so immense it's beyond comprehension. So this, it's revealed, the omnipotence of God is self-revealing. Within this, I always compare it to an electromagnetic field. Within an electromagnetic field then, every little molecule by its choice or decision influences its polarity, its size, its molecular structure. So you choose this, now this little arm is out, now I choose that. Now your gravity pole moves up here, here's your north pole and your south pole. Every little choice affects your configuration and the polarity switches around as you choose yes and no against the various options. Now, that is going to determine where you go in the overall electromagnetic field. Don't forget this field is ultra powerful, infinitely powerful. Everything you've ever done or said throughout all the evolution of your consciousness and all its reincarnations, if they were physical or not, or within the astral realms, every decision and choice now influences your polarity, the intensity of your charge, your configuration. And you automatically gravitate to the field with which you're concordant. Is this field here attracted to this field? No, it hates it. Is this field here attracted to this field? No. These fields automatically gravitate into that with which they are congruent. Therefore, the justice of God is absolute, because each and every one completely and totally themselves determines their ultimate faith via their own choice and by no other. There is no arbitrary God that has to see to it that you go to bad places. That's a fact. Each one automatically. So when you leave the body, at first you may not even notice it, but one is gravitatedly attracted to that with which you are concordant. So there's no point to feeling badly about people that go out the bottom of the box. Life hasn't changed any. Everybody hates everybody and kills everybody here. You go out of body and there you are in a realm where everybody hates everybody and kills everybody. It's wonderful. I mean, right at home, so. Good? Can you imagine somebody dedicated to a life of excitement and danger and drugs and gangster rap and all that crap, being stoned all the time, driving fast cars and being cool? He goes out of body and finds himself in a place where everybody's singing hymns. Man, this is hell. Get me out of here. Get me back where dudes are cool, man. You know what I mean? Shit, it was scary, Maggie. I went to this place and woo, they're all spooky. I mean, they were doing hymns and they had incense around and beautiful shit. Oh, man. It was really scary. Go and tell your doctor about it, Herman. What do you suppose happened, doctor? Well, I don't know what happened. So, what you consider desire. So we create your own eventual potentiality, do you not? By that which you desire and aspire to. Those who aspire to heaven and have like a faith that if they do the best they can from moment to moment, it will all come about. Why should their faith not be fulfilled? You've already chosen your own future, have you not? So why should you experience other than that which you've chosen? So you might say the justice of God is absolute. That which is destined to go here goes here. It doesn't go here and it doesn't go there. If you're destined to go here, this would be like hell and this would be like hell, wouldn't it? Everything floats around gossamer and makes a buzzing noise. You say, this is weird, man. Take me back to good old New York City. You know what I'm saying? I like the sound of the L, you know? All right, so we don't have to worry then because we're only going to experience that which we already are. Because there isn't anything else. I've already answered all these. What a break. I've already answered all these. No, she's been hiding these from me. All right, we're going to take another break, and then after that, I'm going to talk to people who want to speak to me individually. In the 12 lectures, I've tried to provide either the information, the knowledge, or the tools to reach that knowledge of your own. I've tried to make it complete and adequate. First, remove the barriers of the ego, define its structure. Just the knowingness begins to weaken the ego, and then bring up techniques to bring in higher and higher truth now that the ego has been weakened. First we weaken the ego, then we start pulling in the higher energies and what to do all the way to the very end beyond which nothing exists. So we'll take a break and then I'll be happy to greet people and I want to thank you. This has been magnificent, a wonderful year. See what she has to say about it. Give me your arm. Oh, she's enthused also. Well, we always calibrate the energy field of the group, you know, before and after, you know. And then we share it with the group, you know. So today, the energy fuel of the group went up over 20, 25, 30. Oh my God, 35. The energy fuel of this group today went up over 40, 45. Oh my God, a miracle. So, oh my God. Unbelievable. Okay. In the past, the group usually went up 10 each time. Today it was 40. 40 groups. So I give a... I love you all for hearing what I had to say. And for God for lifting us up. So, we're ready to lift our hearts. That is a staggering figure.
Tell us what the numbers were.
I don't remember now. What we're interested in is the shift. I think we started out higher than we were in the past, 440 or something?
No,
440. We started out at 440, 445. We started out a little over 440. The group shot up 40 points. That's incredible. You know, that's a statistical average. Some people here went up probably a couple hundred points. Some go up 150 in a shot like that. And some people probably feel worse. If that's what it all arrives, I'm going back to the streets, boy. All that holy, holy stuff. No, some people here just went way up, you know. I saw it. I saw the light go up on them. So it's the direction that we're going, not how far we are. It's just we're all committed to the same direction. So we all came onto this planet about the same time together. We're all going to be living what seems individually, but actually this group, you know, moves on to another domain, you know. We've probably evolved through many lifetimes together, you know. So we will all be together forever, you know. So. Okay.